A couple of years ago, in 2014, we spoke with Shane Bauer about being imprisoned in Iran for 2 years. This past July, he returned to our show to describe working covertly as a private prison guard in rural Louisiana. And now he's back from another dangerous assignment, spending time with a border militia in order to understand America's paramilitary movement. Shane Bauer is a senior writer for Mother Jones, and his latest story, Undercover with a Border Militia, is in the November-December issue of that magazine. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me back.
How long after ending your undercover operation at the private prison did you decide that you wanted to embed with a militia on the Mexican border?
I actually did that before we published the prison story. It was about, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 months after I left my job in Louisiana, and the prison story was undergoing a lot of fact-checking and things like that, and I wanted to get started on something new. So I joined up with some militias in California initially, and eventually went on to join this national militia, the 3% United Patriots, that was operating on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Do you get bored if you're not in a dangerous situation?
No, not exactly. I was kind of interested in this militia movement because I'd seen them kind of crop up, you know, Bundy Ranch and some other places. And, you know, I was wondering what was happening with them, because there was a long period of time, you know, after the 90s that they kind of disappeared, and we were seeing them kind of pop up again under Obama. So I started just kind of poking around online. I learned that there were some 270 militia groups in the United States right now. And I was surprised to find that they exist now in almost every state, including California. And they have a very kind of rich social media world. And that's kind of where I started. I just opened up a Facebook page and start, you know, following militia groups, and Facebook generated suggestions for other militia pages, and I just kind of blasted out friend requests to people who follow those pages, and really within just a few days, I was pretty deep inside of that world, at least as it exists in social media.
So you can't just show up and say, I'd like to join?
Well, it wasn't actually very difficult. I mean, I just contacted some groups through social media or through their websites and told them that I was interested in joining. And the first time that I did that was with the California State Militia. And they have these semi-regular meetings for new recruits. And I went to one of those in a bowling alley in Livermore, California. And from there, I just started going to trainings. And I trained with this group for several months, and, you know, in the meantime, I was following the group that I was really interested in, which was the 3% United Patriots. I was particularly interested in them because they are nationally organized, which is kind of a new phase of this paramilitary movement, having, you know, branches in several states, mobilizing to places across the country. And one day I saw that they had a posting for a border operation. It was a private Facebook page, and I requested access to the page and was granted access. And essentially there was a post asking who's coming, and I said I was coming. And that was it. I mean, they posted the coordinates, and I just flew to Arizona, rented a truck, and drove out into the desert to these coordinates, which were a kind of, you know, like a something like a small kind of military base that they had set up. And I never had to, you know, interview with anybody. There was no vetting process. I just basically showed up with my camo and rifle. And,
well, let's, you know, back up a bit. You didn't tell them that you were journalists and that you wanted to write about them. Were you concerned? I'm going back to the very beginning. Were you concerned about using your own name? Couldn't any of these militia members have Googled you?
They could have, yes. I mean, I...
Were you vetted?
I mean, I don't think they use Google. You know, they... the interesting thing about these groups is they're very paranoid, but I was so surprised how how little kind of background research they did on me. I didn't tell them I was a journalist, and when I set up my new Facebook page, I didn't put my photo on there, but I also never lied to them, you know, so I was kind of, careful about what I talked about, but, you know, had they Googled me, they would have certainly found out that I was a journalist, that just never came up.
I'm speaking with Shane Bauer, whose latest article is Undercover with a Border Militia. It's in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned weapons. Did you have to bring your own weapons?
Yes, I did. I bought a rifle for this assignment, went to some training on my own before going out with the militia groups. So I had to bring, everybody is required to bring a rifle, ammunition. They also told us to bring body cameras, and the idea was that they would use them, you know, as evidence if somebody falsely accused them of something. But that meant that I was able to openly wear a body camera the whole time I was there and film everything that I saw.
Did they inquire about your politics?
No, never. The something that surprised me about these guys is there wasn't any kind of like, you know, ideological training or anything like that. It was kind of just assumed that everyone was on the same page. And I think people did join the militia for varying reasons. There were some through lines that, like, you know, there's a lot of suspicion of the federal government, sometimes bordering on hatred, a sense of, you know, kind of frustration about, the economic situation in the country. Some guys are military veterans and told me openly that they joined the militia because they missed that kind of military lifestyle. Some guys are, you know, very conspiratorial. One guy told me that he joined because he wanted to train for the day that UN troops invaded the country to take everyone's weapons. So it kind of goes all over the place.
Well, last year, or this year, in fact, it was rumored by some of these groups that the U.S. government was going to come in and take everybody's weapons during training. And, of course, it didn't happen. And there have been a number of warnings in the past. Does that not register with these people?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're preparing for, essentially, you know, the day that the government institutes martial law and comes to take their guns away. A lot of them talk about kind of restoring the Constitution or going back to another time when they, in their view, the country was better off. So they see themselves as kind of protecting an ideal or trying to restore an ideal that has been eroded.
Now, I remember, as you mentioned, that there were a number of prominent militia groups in the past. Did they just continue throughout the years, or did they start growing again after Barack Obama became president?
Yeah, the movement started in the 90s. It really exploded after Waco, and then it kind of started dying down after the Oklahoma City bombing. And once George Bush became president, the movement essentially went to sleep. I mean, there were very few groups in the country. And when Obama was elected, the number of active militias in the country increased eightfold. They weren't necessarily the same groups. I think most of them were new groups, and there was, a lot of them were people that weren't necessarily involved in the 90s. It had a slightly different flavor. There's a movement now called the 3%er movement, which is kind of a grassroots movement, really, and not everybody in that movement is associated with the militia, but they believe that the American Revolution was won by 3% of the population, and that what they have to do now is get 3% of the population behind them to kind of restore the Constitution. And many of the people in this movement are organized into armed militias that do regular training and in some cases do operations like the one that I went to in Arizona.
They call 3% United Patriots, or 3UP.
Yeah.
Now, don't many states have laws that prohibit paramilitary organizations?
They do, yeah.
But you say that they're in almost every state.
Yeah, these groups are essentially saying that they are the same, legally they're the same as the militias of the Revolutionary War time and post-Revolutionary War. And there still are laws on the books allowing for a militia. So in most states, governors could call upon the citizenry as a militia in the case of some kind of emergency. The law does not allow for private groups to train. And as you said, in most states, there are laws prohibiting paramilitary training. These laws have never been enforced on militias. And one of the complicating factors is that generally these laws have to prove that the group is training to in some way cause civil unrest. And that's a very difficult thing to prove.
Do they also invoke the tradition of the posse comitatus as they did in the past?
You know, I never heard them talk about this stuff. I mean, my impression was that most of them were not even aware of the history of the militia movement from the 90s. A lot of them are people who have joined in the last 5 or 8 years. And
a listener asks, what's the age of these guys since they want to go back to a previous time?
It ranges. I mean, there was, you know, from 18 to, you know, 60 years old, you know, mostly white men, mostly working class. They're kind of a big range.
When you say white, mostly working class, and it's men, mm-hmm. Are there ever any women?
There were a couple of women in Arizona. One was somebody who worked in a prison. Not many, though. And some groups that I joined in California specifically said that women were not allowed.
Do you think that the attitudes of these men are representative of white working class voters?
I wouldn't say necessarily. I mean, I think they're an extreme group, you know, and they in some ways are kind of even outside of that type of politics. I was surprised how little the elections were discussed when I was there and the debates. And some of them said that they were voting for Trump, but when they said that, they even kind of couched that, you know, in their suspicion of the federal government. They're careful not to be too excited about any president.
A listener on Twitter asked, do you think that these militias will become more aggressive under a Trump presidency or go to sleep as they did under George W. Bush?
You know, I before Trump was elected, I was saying that, you know, I think that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, their membership would have grown a lot. And I don't think that they're necessarily their numbers are going to grow under Trump. The question is what their focus is going to be now. Some of them I see on Facebook kind of talking about the protests. There's these conspiracy theories that, you know, protesters are being funded by the Democratic Party. So I think that's the thing to kind of watch for, you know, whether we have seen some groups like the Oath Keepers come out armed during protests. And I think that's something to watch for going forward.
And we'll return to that after we take a little break. I'm speaking with Shane Bauer, whose latest article for Mother Jones is Undercover with a Border Militia. It's in the November-December issue of the magazine. Stay with us for more. We are back with Shane Bauer, whose latest article for Mother Jones is Undercover with a Border Militia. It's in the November-December issue of the magazine. You mentioned that they show up at some protests. What were the thoughts on Black Lives Matter and protests against police shootings?
You know, this came up a lot, actually. They view Black Lives Matter as a racist group, and these militias tend to be very defensive about the idea that they're a white supremacist group. They're not the same as the so-called alt-right that's being discussed a lot right now in relation to Trump. They, you know, will say that they're, you know, open to all Americans, all American patriots. At the same time, you know, they are pretty openly disdainful of Black Lives Matter, and they, you know, when I was on the border with these guys, there were, you know, several of them, you know, using the N-word, talking about hunting Mexicans, this kind of stuff. And that's not to say that they're all doing that, but they're, you know, the people that are kind of overtly racist are able to operate in that world without being challenged. You know, there's kind of an idea that, which I think is common on the far right, that, you know, the worst thing you can do is to be offended by anything, and you don't want to give any hint that you are being politically correct. So people don't kind of call out anybody for that kind of behavior.
So that's why you also heard anti-Semitic remarks and anti-Semitic jokes. You heard anti-Hispanic comments.
Yeah.
And you say that the protests at Ferguson were used as a recruiting tool.
Yeah. Numbers,
although they didn't have plans to go to Ferguson.
Yeah, well, militia leaders did say, the leader of 3% United Patriots told me that that their membership took a significant jump when the Ferguson protest happened, which, you know, I think is more than anything an indicator of what is motivating people that are joining these groups. And, you know, I think that a lot of them are, frustrated about the idea that, or the sense in society that people of color and women are kind of demanding equality. And even though they might not see themselves as white supremacists, they are feeling something shift, I think, in society that they're very uncomfortable with.
What was the goal of the Operation Spring Break that you participated in?
The goal was to essentially stop people crossing the border, to find them, whether they be drug smugglers or illegal immigrants.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so these guys, you know, are on this base, and they essentially go out in the daytime and nighttime for operations where they're kind of combing through the desert or maybe setting up on a mountaintop and looking over an area and waiting for people to come across. And, you know, sometimes when we go out on these operations, I'm going riding out in the back of a truck with a bunch of veterans, military veterans who had been to Iraq and Afghanistan. They get really kind of amped up, and there was, you know, it really felt like we were kind of going into battle, and, you know, people are talking about hunting Mexicans, and, you know, I was never really told explicitly what I was to do if we found somebody. My understanding was that we were to radio the base, and the base would radio the Border Patrol. But it wasn't hard to imagine the situation in which somebody jumps out from behind a bush in the dark and someone gets shot. And in fact, you know, while I was out there, there was an instance when the Border Patrol saw us out there with their infrared technology at night and approached one of the squads of militiamen. And there was a period where there was a standoff where they were all pointing their weapons at each other before they realized you know, who they were.
But didn't they have a pretty good relations with Border Patrol and the local police?
Yeah, this was the thing that probably surprised me more than anything. The Federal Border Patrol not only tolerated them operating out there, but they actually worked with them pretty closely. The instance I just described, when there was an armed standoff, I came on that scene just minutes after it happened. I saw the Border Patrol, and I assumed that they were going to, you know, tell us to leave. But instead, we walked to the side of the road, and one of the Border Patrol agents said that he was an intelligence officer of the area, and he started discussing with the leader of the militia, you know, where we should be setting up. He took us on a drive and showed us where we should start doing our operations to find people. And he told them that he would start sending them intelligence briefings, even when they were back home in Colorado. And I actually later, before publishing the story, I reached out to the leader of the militia, Mike Morris, and I told him that I was a journalist, asked him if he would do an interview, and he agreed. And he told me that he was still in communication with the Border Patrol on a weekly basis, and that over the years that they'd been doing these operations, they always work with the Border Patrol, and they'll call them before they set up an operation, and the Border Patrol will tell them when to come and where to go.
And you even recorded video of a Border Patrol agent offering to cooperate with the militia.
I did, yeah.
Wouldn't that be illegal?
He's saying to them, to work with them, I mean, that's a big question, especially the sharing of intelligence. You know, he said to the militia, I'm glad that you guys come down here and do my job for me for no pay at all. And the reality is when the militia is down there, they far outnumber and outgun the Border Patrol.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and you know, the Border Patrol agents would come to the base regularly. They'd, you know, bring us donuts. They'd play with the militiamen's guns. I mean, it was a very amicable relationship. And the militia, you know, the leader was telling the Border Patrol about this training school that they have where they practice waterboarding. They strap recruits to tilt tables, blindfold them, tase them, cattle prod them. So it's not as if the Border Patrol does not realize, what kind of people these are.
Weren't there times when you were asked to provide cover for a patrol? Did you plan on what you would do if you saw these men trying to shoot or kill someone in the desert?
That was something that I was definitely concerned about. The reality is when I was out there on the patrols, there was no going back. I didn't have cell phone coverage. I was out in the middle of the desert, kind of at the mercy of these guys. And there was one instance when I was out on patrol with two other guys. And, you know, there were times when it seemed almost ridiculous. I mean, I'm with a guy who's carrying a sword. We're out in the desert, and they're following these what they say are footprints that I literally can't see. They say that they're moccasin prints, and we're walking all over the desert, and it seems like almost a fantasy, like a kind of some kind of video game. But of course, you know, they also have semi-automatic rifles, and we eventually came upon a food and water drop. There were backpacks with, you know, candy bars and canned fish and jugs of water. And they, you know, stabbed the water jugs, poured all the water out. And, I was certainly tempted to say something, because this obviously could have been a lifeline for somebody coming through the desert. But, you know, when I'm out there in the middle of the desert with these guys, I really have to be careful about, what I was saying and how it was coming across.
Although you never did encounter anyone trying to cross the border.
No, I didn't. I know that these guys had in past operations, but it didn't happen while I was there.
Weren't some of your fellow militiamen also concerned about Muslims in this country? Did they imagine that Muslims would try to cross the border? Someone from ISIS might try to infiltrate the United States across the Mexican border?
Yeah, Muslims came up a lot. And, you know, I really think after spending all this time with the militias, which are part of, you know, a broader kind of far-right patriot movement, that while many are careful not to be openly racist about African Americans, it is entirely acceptable to be racist against Arabs and Muslims. And, you know, they would talk about, you know, Muslims taking over their cities, Sharia law, and they, you know, said that someday soon, ISIS is going to be integrating with the Mexican cartels, and they're going to be coming across the border, and they saw themselves as kind of holding the line and being the defenders in a way against ISIS. And, you know, I think...
And you and blue helmets, you say.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think these stories over time, as the years pass, the story about what they're doing and what they're protecting against changes, and it almost seems like it's these kind of stories give them this sense of valor and, you know, a way to justify essentially, you know, doing kind of battle operations on American soil.
Didn't one of the men call this his therapy?
Yes, he was a veteran of Afghanistan. He was known by the name Iceman, and he said to me, you know, after he came back from Afghanistan, he was feeling lost, and he joined the militia. And he said that being in the Arizona desert reminded him of Afghanistan, and that it was therapy for him.
Does this give these men a sense of community?
I think so. And, you know, I think, you know, some of these guys are, you know, just kind of living in the suburbs, seem fairly alienated and paranoid. And, you know, there's a way the militia movement kind of walks a fine line, you know, where the leaders, I mean, when I went to join various groups, I got a sense from the leaders that they were kind of trying to suss out, you know, how much of a loose cannon that I was. And, you know, I think that they do have concerns that people that are associated with them are going to explode in some form. And so there's a way in which the militias are kind of containing and giving some meaning and association to guys who are fairly volatile and alienated. But on the other side, they're also kind of, you know, justifying kind of fantasies of insurrection and paranoia. And there have been a number of cases over the last five or ten years of militia groups kind of going rogue and, you know, building bombs, planning attacks on government buildings. There was even a case in Georgia of a militia man, a militia leader, murdering his pregnant wife to get life insurance money and fund his militia. And his group also ended up killing two more people who were close to the militia that they feared knew too much about what they were doing.
These militiamen are heavily armed. They're angry. You say many of them could be described as paranoid. Were you worried about being targeted after you published the article? Have you received any threats or harassment since the article went live?
Yeah, I mean, I won't say that's something I didn't think about. I mean, I was more nervous about the group that I was with in Arizona than I was about the California militias. I did reach out to all of them before I published the article, and everybody who appears in the article, I contacted, told them that I was writing the article and asked if they would be interviewed. So they knew it was coming, and a surprising number of them actually did agree to be interviewed, which on some level was reassuring. The leader of the group did an interview, and we also published that online. So, you know, there's in this kind of work, there's no guarantee. You know, I tried to be aware. I, you know, monitor the the Facebook page still. But I was actually surprised to see in that world on Facebook how many people actually liked the article.
That Shame. Was something I did we not have to leave it there. Try not to live such a dangerous life in the future. Shane Bauer's latest article is Undercover with a Border Militia. It's in the November-December issue of Mother Jones.